All right. Well, okay. It's so good to have you here tonight to get us started off in a good way. It's wonderful to be here to study with you and to study the story of Jesus. Tell me the story of Jesus. It has swept the earth, and from its very smallest beginning to an ending that I think human beings can't even comprehend, and we're waiting to see that, and the sooner the better for me. I'm thankful to be a part of it. I'm thankful you're a part of it, and I'm thankful to be a part of you, and may God bless us tonight. We have a picture of the Sea of Galilee tonight that you can see. That one that Neil had us looking at, and we've even got a second one that we can see. Okay, well, this is a wonderful occasion, and I want to welcome you again and give you the outline of the four lessons. The one tonight is called The Revolt by the Sea. You'll understand more about that shortly. Tomorrow night, we're going to look at discipleship by the sea, but in the sense of the assurances Jesus gave. So many times he said, "Don't be afraid." Don't be afraid. It's a magnificent phrase that he used over and over. Many of those were used on the Sea of Galilee. And then the third evening, Tuesday evening, we'll study instruction by the sea, and we'll talk there out of the Sermon on the Mount. And then breakfast by the sea, you're aware of what that would probably be in John 21. And we're going to look at some things that probably you've not thought about before. I hadn't either. And I think you'll appreciate some of the resurrection proofs and appearances that we'll talk about at that time. A seaside with the Savior is an appropriate topic. Much of Jesus' early ministry was done in, on, or around the Sea of Galilee. And four of his 12 disciples, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, came from Capernaum and Bethsaida. And many of his teachings were taught while he was sitting in a boat on the sea. You're aware of all of this. Neil mentioned it this morning. Here's something you may not be aware of. In the book of Mark, the Sea of Galilee, and boats play a major role. The sea and boats play a major role, especially in chapters 4, 1 through 8, 21. We're not going to study that particularly tonight, but I want to just mention that this is one of the turning points in the Gospel of Mark in the life of Jesus. In chapter 4 of Mark, in verse 1, we have this parable, the parable of the soils. The parable of the soils represents a turning point in the Gospel. Jesus equates the good soil to these disciples who have been given the secret of the kingdom of God. From this point on, he spends proportionately less time with unproductive audiences, the hard and thorny and shallow soils, to use the words of the parable, and increased time and effort with soil which will produce a crop. Now, this is the parable at the beginning of chapter 4, verse 1. The boat and sea section of Mark is 4:1 through 8:21. And in there, you find him making this transition away from the people who are on the outside to these people who are on the inside, the 12, and more time he spends with them. They travel with him everywhere. They witness powerful signs. They're commissioned to minister in Jesus' name, and they receive increasingly rigorous instruction. And though Jesus is actively engaged with the sick and the demon-possessed and with large crowds during this phase of his ministry, the distinct impression gained from reading of Mark 4, 1 through 8, 21 is that these people and events are background. So in this particular section, we'll notice that Mark is concerned with the boat and with the sea. 18 times in the Gospel of Mark, the word boat is used. 18 times. Matthew uses it 12 times. And let me make some application here. Do you have any awareness that the boat represents the church for the early Christians? Let me read you something. I think this is written, I'm not sure who wrote it. I think Tim wrote it. For Mark to use a boat as a metaphor, and a metaphor is a striking way of comparing one thing with another, that would not be unusual. In fact, early Christians were prone to adopt the metaphor of a boat for their thinking about the church. They marked their meeting places with rough scratchings of a boat and sail. And that's also another mark was what? Another figure was the figure of the fish. You remember the figure of the fish? Well, there was also the figure of the boat and sail that they used to indicate where they were meeting. Among the earliest Christian artworks are representations of the church as a boat transporting and sheltering Christians through stormy and dangerous times. The church fathers made references to Peter's teaching about Noah, 1 Peter 3, and went beyond the apostle in recognizing not just the water as a type of baptism, but the ark as a metaphor for the church. In a letter attributed to Clement, the apostle Peter is portrayed as laying hands upon Clement and ordaining him as a bishop. In the homily which follows, Peter describes the church in these terms: "For the whole business of the church is like unto a great ship, bearing through a violent storm men who are out of many places and who desire to inhabit the city of the good kingdom. Let therefore God be your shipmaster, and let the pilot be likened to Christ. Let those sailing expect every tribulation as traveling over a great and troubled sea, the world." So what we're studying tonight is not new to Christian thinking. Christians have thought about the church as the ark, and the church as the boat, and Mark uses that. We're not going to specialize in that tonight, but I just wanted to use it as a means of introduction. Neil introduced also the Sea of Galilee this morning, just very briefly. It's called by four names: Gennesaret, Chinnereth, Tiberias, and Galilee. And one of the things that I read said that the designation of the Sea of Galilee, or called by that name, there's no record of it ever being called the Sea of Galilee until the Gospel writers used that term. And if Mark was the first of those to write the Gospel, then he would be the first one to have used the designation, at least that we have any record of. It's about 13 miles or 14 miles from north to south, 7 to 8 miles from east to west, and it served as a natural border between Jew and Gentile. If you'll notice, I'll use this little marker. The Sea of Galilee served as this border. On the eastern shore were the 10 cities called the Decapolis. On the western shore, there was the Jewish nation. And this observation might explain the presence of those pigs in the incident we noticed this morning. Neil talked about the casting of the demons out of the man and into the pigs. It might explain why there were people there keeping as many as 2,000 pigs. Now, as you know, Jews were not allowed to eat pig meat or pork. It's interesting to notice that those Jews who were not kosher Jews, or those who were less concerned about the restriction, they didn't keep pigs. They kept zebras. Zebras. Now, these were just as much a pig. They were pigs, but they just named them zebras so they could keep them. The Jews were a lot like us today. They would climb a tree and cross a road in order to get around something that they didn't really want to do anyway. And so it's not, don't criticize them too much. We're a lot like that ourselves in a lot that we do. Now, Mark 6, 30 through 46. If you'll turn in your Bibles to Mark 6, 30 through 46. This is one major event on the sea. It's the feeding of the 5,000. And I'm going to just take a moment to read that, because that's where we'll be coming out of tonight. Mark 6, 30 through 46. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Just prior to that, look back in chapter 5, just for background. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Now that's where they met the man who was possessed of the demons. After he cast the demons out of there, they left there, and that's down here in the, that's down in this lower part in here. There's Gadara, the Gadarenes, the Gerasenes, is right down in here. And that's, he didn't usually go that far south, not on the eastern shore. But they had been in a storm. And I think that explains why they ended up way down there in the other end of the lake. not where they were intending to go, but where they went because of the storm. They left there, though, the Gerasenes, the Gadarenes, and went over and sailed back into Capernaum. That's in chapter 5 and verse 21. And then in chapter 6 and verse 1, he left there and went back to Nazareth, to his hometown. And he was accompanied by his disciples, and that's where he began to teach, and they were very unreceptive to him. And then in chapter 6 and verse 30, we'll pick up here, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Before this, Jesus had sent these men out to preach and teach and cast out demons. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they didn't even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time it was late in the day, so the disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy them something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." They said, "That would take 8 months of a man's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down on groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the five loaves and the two fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples. He also divided the two fish among them. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of men who had eaten was about 5,000. This feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle recorded by the Lord that is recorded in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, that ought to tell us something. It's the only one. There's not another one that's recorded by all four Gospels. The one in Matthew is Matthew 14, 13 through 21. The one in Luke is Luke 9, 10 through 17. And then in John 6, 1 through 15, we'll be noticing that in just a few moments. I'm suggesting that here in Mark 6, 30 through 46, and in John 6, 1 through 15, particularly tonight, we're witnessing another turning point. Another turning point in the life of Jesus. This turning point that we noticed a moment ago that took place here in Mark 4:1, where he begins teaching about the outsiders and the insiders. And from Mark 4:1 through 8:21, you have this concentrated section in the book of Mark that deals with the sea and the boat and him being with his disciples in a very close and confidential way. Here in Mark, the 6th chapter, verses 30 through 46, is another watershed. And this one is a violent watershed. There aren't many places, well, I'm not sure that's true. I started to say there aren't many places in which violence is a part of Jesus' life, but that's not really true. They threw him out of Nazareth and tried to kill him there in Mark, isn't it Mark 4, where they tried to kill him? Of course, they ended up killing him some 3 years later. But anyway, here is a place that it seems that something almost got out of control. And I'll explain that in just a few moments. But I'm suggesting that we're witnessing a turning point here, a drastic one, more drastic than the one in Mark 4:1, a more violent one, to the point that I think you can call this a watershed in the ministry of Jesus. There were at least these three watersheds. This one is not all that noticeable in Mark 4:1. The one here is very noticeable in the sense that it's violent. It is one that throws him into an all-night, or not all-night, but into a long-night prayer session. It's a watershed that causes him to use physical force. We'll get to that in a few moments. On his disciples. And then there's one, of course, in Mark 11, 1 through 11. His triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Each of these watersheds is accompanied by a decline in discipleship. Every one of these, at certain points, Jesus would come to a position where he was popular in the thinking of the people. And there would be a watershed and he would decline. The people would leave him, or he would leave them. Then there would be another gaining of popularity, and then there would be another decline, and then another gaining of popularity, and another decline, until finally they executed him, as you're well aware. Those three watersheds, but we'll not spend a lot of time except talking about this one. There's a parallel passage. Turn to John, the 6th chapter. John 6 is parallel to Mark 6. And you're familiar with probably this one more than you are the one in Mark. But in the first 15 verses of the 6th chapter of John, John tells this same feeding of the 5,000, but he lists certain details that Mark doesn't mention. Put them together and you have quite an interesting scenario. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near, so John identifies it as the Passover. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy food for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here's a boy with 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over, let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves and left over of those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake. So there's that incident recorded in John. Mark says, and we'll come to that in just a moment, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But what are you to make of this initial disappointment there in 6:15, where Jesus disappointed the people? They were going to come and take him and make him king by force. He put a stop to that. And then in the 66th verse of the 6th chapter of John, it says they said, "This is a hard saying," after he had talked to them about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, and that if they did that, they had life in themselves. When they heard this terribly irritating, and they just couldn't imagine cannibalism, and they took it to mean literally eat his flesh and literally drink his blood. It says when they heard this, they said, "This is a hard saying. Who can accept it?" And it said from that point on, many went back and didn't follow him any longer. So there again is this same reference to this crisis at which time the people departed and left Jesus. But what are we going to make of it? And then there's a passage, turn back to Mark again, the 6th chapter. There is an unusual statement here. In Mark, the 6th chapter, in verse 51. Now, after he had dismissed the crowd, after the feeding of the 5,000, he made his disciples, it said, get in the boat and go to Bethsaida. Then he went up into a mountain and prayed for, I don't know how long, a good long while. And then he came to them walking on the water. He got into the boat, and that's what the background of this is. Immediately, okay, they cried out in verse 49 and 50 because they all saw him and they were terrified. Immediately he spoke out and said, "Take courage, it's I, don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed. Now listen to this. For they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Now you know, that says something if you'll ponder it a moment. What is it saying? The initial disappointment about his not letting them make him king, later on, after they got over there in John, and the people left him. But in this event here, after he had left the crowd, and the crowd had been dismissed, and the disciples had been sent away, he walked on the water toward them, and it terrified and scared them to death, no doubt. And then he got in the boat, and it just simply says they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Had not understood what about the loaves? And what does it mean when it says their hearts were hardened? Let me read some things to you that I think will make this meaningful to us. In answer to this question, and I've written some things out of a book called The Jewish World in the Time of Jesus. The only way to understand Jesus' own career as Messiah is to restore it to its proper background and surroundings, the historical development that led up to it, and in a very real sense, conditioned it. And here's what he says was the condition at the time that Jesus was living and at the time that this messianic anticipation was high. Economic ills were gnawing at the very life of the people, the Jewish people. Not only fugitive slaves, but also miserable free working men often organized bands to attack merchants and other wayfarers. Robbery became a permanent feature of Palestinian life. Even the general pacification of the country by the Herodian and Roman armies failed to eradicate the evil. Since the dominant class in Rome was vitally interested in preserving robbery and piracy throughout the Mediterranean as the main source of slave supply, Roman police action was half-hearted. Anyway, here's another thought. Almost anyone could engage the attention of people brought to despair by the overwhelming power of Rome and the dismal domestic situation. What he's describing here is the background out of which this messianic hope had become so fervent. These people were caught up in a fervor of messianic expectation. The Jewish people had for some years been expecting God to send his Messiah to get those stinking Romans off their back. They hated them. They hated their occupation of their country. And every year around the time of the Passover, this messianic expectation would rise to a fever pitch. And he says part of the reason why it became so feverish is that the people's economic situation was so dismal. And he said almost anyone could engage the attention of a people brought to despair by the overwhelming power of Rome and the dismal domestic situation. Deceivers and imposters, writes unsympathetic Josephus, under the pretense of divine inspiration, fostering revolutionary changes, they persuaded the multitude to act like madmen and led them out into the desert under the belief that God would then give them tokens of deliverance. After the death in 44, after the death of Agrippa I, a prophet named Theudas was easily able to assemble a large crowd whom he led to the Jordan, promising to divide its waters. You recognize the name Theudas? Okay. There were two of these would-be messiahs mentioned in the book of Acts. Theudas and who was the other one? Theudas and Judas. Well, okay. And then also in Acts, the 21st chapter, remember when Paul was being brought into the barracks and he said, "May I speak to these people?" They were trying to kill him. And Paul said to the centurion, "Can I speak to these people?" And the man said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not then the Egyptian who led out a certain number of revolutionaries?" Paul said, "No, I'm a Jew." This Egyptian Messiah appeared and brought 30,000 Jerusalem Jews to the Mount of Olives, declaring that he would show them from hence how at his command the walls of Jerusalem would fall down. Roman soldiers speedily and bloodily suppressed both commotions. It's no exaggeration to say that just before the birth of Jesus, speculations as to the date and duration of the messianic reign, the coming of the Messiah, the day of Yahweh, the resurrection, and the last judgment were central in Jewish thought and occupied the chief place among the politico-religious questions which engrossed the inhabitants of Palestine. The scribes discussed them in their schools. They were the inspiration of the synagogues, and the common people found in their expectation of what was to come consolation and stimulus, not unmixed with anxiety. Oh, it's such a broad painting and a scenario that lets us understand what it was that the people were expecting. You know, Jesus had this problem with them, misunderstanding his nature of his kingdom. His own disciples didn't understand. Certainly the people that he was talking to didn't understand that he was not coming to establish a physical, materialistic, and military regime. The most convincing, and let me see if this is the same, the Jewish world in the time of Jesus. This other one, there's another book that I quoted out of, The Social and Religious History of the Jews by Salo W. Baron. I've got all of these documentations if you want them. The most convincing proof of the practical importance of messianism, about the time of Jesus is the state of emotional upheaval persisting in Israel, a state which would otherwise be quite unmotivated and which can only be explained by the messianic hope. And then here are some, just listen to this. During the century which preceded the birth of Jesus, and still more during the two centuries which followed, this state of unrest gave rise to various popular movements of more or less importance, which did serious harm to the Jewish nation and led at last to its final downfall. Each visionary who arose, each rebel who incited Israel to take arms, could count on a following who would be ready to hail him as the long-awaited Messiah. Do you know how many of these would-be Messiahs, do you know how many there were prior to and following the coming of Jesus, his birth and all? And this, if you'll take a period of time approximately 50 years prior to his birth and 50 years after his birth, you have any idea how many people, how many men stood up as messiahs saying, "I'm the one"? And how many of those that stood up saying, "I'm the one," were militaristic, nationalistic Jewish people? They were so rabid. And the reason why they took those dates, it dates back into the book of Daniel. We won't have time to even start to talk about that. But there was a prophecy in Daniel that even gave the dates when the Messiah would come and be cut off. You're familiar with that, out of Daniel 7 and Daniel 9, those prophecies in there, representing 483 years from the time that the decree was sent out to rebuild Jerusalem. That's the scene that Daniel paints for the coming of the Messiah. The Jewish people understood the prophecies well enough to know that the coming of the Messiah would come within a certain span. That span was 93 years. The reason why the uncertainty was because there was more than one decree that was sent out to rebuild Jerusalem. And dating the coming of the Messiah 483 years from this first proclamation to rebuild would have put it at this date, and dating that date from the latter, the fourth of these proclamations, would put it way on down another 93 years. That 93-year period can serve as a circumference around the birth of Jesus, and as a result of that, there were Jewish revolutionaries who began about the time of that first proclamation coming true, and that ended at the time of the last one coming true, and you have this constant fanning of the revolutionary messianic flame. There were 64 would-be Christs, 64 false messiahs who came during that 93 or about 100-year period before Jesus and after him. Put a 50 years before him and after him, and there were 64 of them standing up and saying, "I'm the Christ, I'm the Messiah." All 64 of them were militaristic, nationalistic Jewish people, rabid, and they wouldn't think 2 seconds about taking your head off if you were a Roman. The only one of the 65, Jesus being one of the 65, Jesus was the only one who came proclaiming a kingdom of peace, a kingdom of righteousness, a kingdom of holiness. He was the only one that came not as a revolutionary in a sense of undermining the Roman Empire. Of all those men, 64 of them were revolutionaries in the sense of being absolute rebels. Jesus was the other one. I bet you can't name the other ones. You don't know any of them except Judas and Thutis and the man from Egypt, and he's not even named. We don't know any except we know the name of Jesus. Okay, now, let's, if you will, turn back to the book of Mark, and let me just kind of play back and forth with these two, John 6 and Mark 6. What we're witnessing, and I want to say this up front, so having read the background and all, what we're witnessing in Mark 6 and in John 6, we're witnessing Jesus narrowly averting a popular messianic uprising. That's what we're watching. I think we're seeing him doing battle, trying to keep the thing under control. The people were just frantic. They were trying to find somebody that could lead them into freedom and deliver them from the Roman Empire. And there were uprisings. It seems like they came about every Passover. When spring came, when kings go out to war, these uprisings multiplied. And so Jesus, when he came, it was about the Passover time when this event in the desert took place. And I'm suggesting, along with the man by the name of Hugh Montefiore, in an article entitled Revolt in the Desert. Write that down, Revolt in the Desert, and I have the documentation on it. I'll get it for you later. He affirms that we're looking at this, we're witnessing Jesus narrowly averting a typical messianic uprising. Now, let's turn in our texts and just notice some very interesting statements that Mark makes as he records this event. In verse 31, then because so many people were coming and going that they didn't even have a chance to eat. People were coming and going. There's not any other place where it is mentioned like that. There were a lot of people sitting there that were wanting to touch him, but this mentioned that there were so many people coming and going. I wonder what that indicates. It's a unique expression. But there were so many people coming and going that they didn't even have time to eat. Okay, put that in the hopper and we'll look at it in a minute. In verse 31, the latter part of that, he says to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from the towns and got there ahead of them. That'll work. Or we could do what Neil did. This is Galilee at night. This will give us some idea. He cast the demons into the pigs here. They then went back up to Capernaum. And then he sent his disciples out, and they came back to him and reported. And there was so much activity going and coming, people coming in and out, that they didn't even have a chance to eat. And then he said, come and let's go to a quiet place. Now Luke says that it was in Bethsaida. Look over in Luke the 9th chapter, if you want to just check it. Luke says that they went to Bethsaida. But he also says in verse 10 of chapter 9, when the apostles returned, they reported to Jesus what they had done. Then he took them with him, and they withdrew by themselves to a town called Bethsaida. But they didn't go into the town, because just after that it says down in verse 12, late in the afternoon the 12 came to him and said, send the crowd away so they can go to the surrounding villages and countryside and find food and lodging, because we are in a remote place. So it was only in the general vicinity of this little town of Bethsaida where he fed the 5,000. And it was there, from there, that he told them to get in the boat and go. So they went by themselves to this solitary place. People saw them going, followed them. By that time, in verse 35, it was late in the day. Jesus said, let's feed them ourselves. They found 5 loaves and 2 fish. They did feed them. There were about 5,000 men. And the 5,000 men, and Matthew says, without the admixture of women. Now there's a bit of uncertainty as to whether that means there were women there also, or that this was just a band, this was just 5,000 men without any women. In view of the circumstances and in view of the parallel passages, it makes me think that he was simply saying this is a group of 5,000 men and that there were no women a part of it. Okay, in verse 3, it says, "So when Jesus landed and saw the large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd." They were like sheep without a shepherd. That's a reference to Numbers, the 27th chapter and verse 16. It's when Moses was asking God, "Provide us with a leader for these people. Provide us with a general for the army," is what he was asking for. So God instructed Moses to select Joshua. And Moses asked the Lord, "Please give us a leader for these people to go into the land of Canaan so they will not be like sheep without a shepherd." This was a military expression that harks back to Numbers, the 27th chapter. When Jesus saw the crowds there on the shore, he said they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so he began to teach them many things. I wonder what he began to teach them. If it compares to what he taught them over in the 8th chapter of Mark, he was trying to show them the difference between his kingdom and the kingdom they were expecting. And he was talking in the 8th chapter to his own disciples, and they didn't understand. I don't doubt but what he was trying to show them the same thing here. We don't know. Sheep without a shepherd. In Mark 6:34, he began to teach them these many things and the nature of his kingdom in contrast to their own expectations. Look at the next verse. In verse 39, Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. Now that indicates that it was in the springtime, but we don't have to guess as to when it was. John says that the Jewish Passover was near. And you know that's right at the early part, March and April of the year. He sat them down in groups of 50 and 100. We don't particularly know why, except that perhaps for distribution purposes. 50 and 100 were also military indications or military groupings. They're just some things that you have to surmise, and we don't want to overemphasize that. But just at this point, I want you to look at John, the 6th chapter and verse 15. After he had fed them, everybody ate and had what they needed. After he fed them, then it says, Jesus perceived that they were going to come and take him and make him king by force. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. And then if you'll go back to Mark and look at verse 45, after it says they all ate and were satisfied. Now here's where John and Mark converge, and their stories complement each other. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat. That's what I meant when I said he resorted to violence, just to physical force. The word here for made is a Greek word, enonkesin. Enonkesin. In the parallel passage in Matthew, Matthew uses the same word. Both Matthew and Mark use this word. Luke and John don't. But Matthew and Mark, as they talk about how Jesus got the disciples away from this volatile situation, Matthew says, as Mark does, Jesus enonkesin. He forced them. He made them. And this word is used later on in the book of Acts when Paul describes his conduct toward the Christians. He said, "I tried to make them blaspheme." That's how that word is used. It's never used again. Jesus never used that, or it's never used anywhere else in the Gospels to describe Jesus' action toward his disciples or anybody else for that matter. These two occasions, it says he made them get in the boat and get out of there. Well, what about it? What does it mean? What are the implications? And then there's that strange comment on down in verse 51. After he had come to them walking on the water. Well, here's an interesting thought. In verse 45, where does it say he sent them? Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to where? To Bethsaida. But they were in this horrific storm. And look where they end up. When they had crossed over, they landed where? They landed at Capernaum. Or Gennesaret. Here's Gennesaret, on down here. There's Capernaum. They left there, went over here somewhere near Bethsaida. But trying to get back to Bethsaida, the wind blew them clear over here to Gennesaret. That's some 8 or 10 or 12 miles. away from where they were headed. And they anchored there. And there's that verse just above there. After he had finished walking on the sea, he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they did not understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. I think what we're watching that time in the life of Jesus when it came to a head, when the situation was so volatile, he narrowly escaped. He narrowly put down this uprising that was so common to the Jewish people. They were on their way to a messianic revolt, and they were going to take Jesus by force and make him king to lead them in this revolt. And that's when he just told his disciples, he dismissed the crowd, he said, "You're dismissed." He told his disciples, get in the boat and get out of here. Well, why was he telling them that? Looks like they could have helped him put down this revolt. No. The disciples were part of the revolt. I'm convinced the disciples didn't any more understand what was going on. It says their hearts were hardened. They didn't understand about the loaves. Because you see, one of the messianic expectations was that when the Messiah came, he was going to bring bread to everybody. Everybody was going to be fed. And the Jews thought that. The disciples had bought into it. And I think, frankly, that he had to get his disciples out of there because they were part of the problem, not a part of the answer. Bless his heart, he dismissed the crowd, sent his disciples away by force, and went up into the mountain and just kind of said, "Phew, that was a close one." And he spent time in prayer with his Father, came down, got in the boat, or walked across the sea to the boat, and there the disciples were sitting there sulking. That's what you get from this. That's what I get from here. They were sitting there sulking. They didn't understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. I think they were thinking, and this is my supposition, I think they were thinking, "Good grief, you missed the chance of a lifetime. We had 5,000 revolutionaries waiting on us, and you dismissed them. You really blew it." They wouldn't dare say that to him like that. But what they were capable of was pouting and sulking. And when he came and got in the boat, there they were, hard-hearted, not understanding what had happened. Jesus knew, and he knew that that's not the direction that he was going. When they got over to Gennesaret and went on up to Capernaum, and the people there learned that Jesus was not any longer there on the eastern shore, the people came over in some other boats that came from Tiberias. Here's Tiberias, right there. We walked once from Tiberias, virtually about right in there, all the way up to Capernaum. It's a good long trek, but that's where they came from. The boats came from Tiberias, came over to up to where they'd eaten the loaves, and then came on over to Capernaum, and Jesus there taught them this startling lesson out of John, the 6th chapter, as it's recorded, about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. And that's when they said, "We can't stand. That's ridiculous.